The Annie Altman Show podcast and other projects are field research for the Hugh Manny. Hey, it's Annie. Please check out and share the website, Patreon, and Etsy to help support these projects and my self-project. The Hugh Manny is a one-woman show about how no one ever fully figures out how to be a human being, how there's themes of the human being experience organized into 10 C words connected by the theme of connection, and how discussing these themes we all experience somehow is my best idea to contribute to minimizing unnecessary human suffering through maximizing resource equity. That was a lot of words. Maybe note when you hear the words connection, consciousness, choice, change, compassion, communication, community, creation, charge, curiosity, and or courage in this episode. That's also a lot of words. Here's some more. Hello and welcome to the Annie Altman Show, the podcast, season 5. Welcome to the 9th episode on consciousness. Today, I'm here virtually with Jess Lynn. Welcome, Jess. Thank you for being here with all of our different technological difficulty games.
Hi, Annie. So nice to be on here. Thanks for having me. I definitely agree that we've been through some challenges, but that's what makes life so exciting. It's just an adventure, right?
Whatever words we want to pick for it. We have gone through several an app, and now we are here recording.
Very cool, very cool. Thanks so much for your patience.
Yeah, thank you for yours. I would love for you to share a little bit with the people listening about what you like to do both professionally and personally as it connects to consciousness.
Sure. So professionally, I am a life and business coach. I work with creatives to not only increase their income and find clients that are nourishing, but also to conduct their life in such a way that is really sustainable, which means getting enough sleep, exercising, and really feeling at zen with themselves and taking things at their own pace. So a lot of times, you know, people have the strategy and they are hustling hard, but they get so lost in working crazy hours that they lose themselves. And, you know, with that kind of pattern, you know, you can make 6, 7, 8 figures, but if you drop dead the next day, unfortunately, it's not very useful. You can't take your money to the grave, right, as they say. So in my free time, I enjoy doing yoga and meditation. Lately, I've been going on long walks around the neighborhood. So I recently issued myself a 7-day challenge where I walked outside for minimum half an hour at a time. And most days I did an hour to an hour and a half, and I actually did accomplish it. So it was quite, I was quite impressed with myself.
It feels so good to do a thing that you've said is important to you.
Yes, and I think it really helped that I, you know, said it out loud. And I put it on my Instagram. So I feel like, you know, people are watching and it was like motivating. So I know like some of my clients are starting to do it as well. And so it just feels really good.
That like relying on the collective consciousness or putting it out in words to then get it in your conscious body.
Exactly. And we're all united as one, you know, so it makes sense to kind of spread it around because it just kind of comes back to oneself, you know? And I think that walking around, especially without any music or without listening to podcasts, I mean, occasionally I will, you know, like jump on a call with a friend, but I think just walking around is a type of consciousness in that, you know, I'm kind of really engaged with the present, with my surroundings, and, you know, I'm really taking in the rest of the world rather than just, you know, just the one space or one spot in my room or in the house.
Yeah, I relate to that one for sure. I know learning about mindful walking and mindful movement was and is a really important way to make seated, still meditation and mindfulness practices actually accessible for me.
Exactly. I love that word accessibility. I use it constantly. And I think it's really important because consciousness can be such an intimidating word, to be honest, when you first approached me with it, I thought, man, that's a deep one. I'm not sure if I'm equipped to, you know, speak about it. And, you know, I think it comes with a lot of responsibility. So it, absolutely, accessibility makes it so key so that all of us can really tune into it and not just those of us, you know, like the Buddha or the Dalai Lama who are enlightened, right? It's really, you know, available to ordinary people like you and me.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up and involved someone coming and being like, hey, you want to start a podcast on consciousness? Is that moment of, so we want to be aware of awareness, or what are we even, how are we even going to access this thing to talk about, that it is, like you said, it's so, it can be easy to put consciousness with this super hyper Zen Buddha, like you were saying. And The funny part is, in so many ways, is that it's also the wherever you go, there you are. We're all with ourselves. We're all with our consciousness all the time, to some level, to some capacity.
We're speaking the same language, I think. Wherever you go, there you are is a great motto. I actually am in a meditation circle where the leader will read from that book. I believe it's by Jon Kabat-Zinn, if I'm remembering correctly. And I think that we just get so distracted by everything around us. And of course, it's all, you know, calculated that way by society and the media. And so, you know, the point that you're hitting, I think, is that consciousness should be a given, right? Everyone should be able to attain it and have it in their grasp. And yet it's kind of chiseled away at, I think, by all of the flashy things that we don't need, the TVs and the cars and big houses and all of the unnecessary things. And the consciousness kind of just falls to the wayside quite rapidly.
Definitely in that attachment to materialism. I've also found for me, getting attached to consciousness, getting attached to the pursuit of consciousness and growth, and that I've also become less conscious, ironically, in that attachment as well. I don't know if along, like, if that's an experience you can relate to at all along your experience with mindfulness practices, like that grasping at them, or like trying, quote unquote, really hard to meditate.
Absolutely. I think that hits the nail on the head, where I battle between accepting myself but also wanting to improve. And where is the line between that, right? Because if I really accept myself as I am, then why do I need to change, right? So it does seem paradoxical or ironic. It's quite funny, actually. And it really does present itself in my meditations, because, you know, meditation nowadays, a lot of us see it as, like, you know, sitting on a cushion, closing our eyes, chanting Om. And that is one type of, you know, consciousness, one type of meditation. However, we've, you know, forgotten about meditation that just comes with living our lives. For example, really being present when you're doing your laundry and not multitasking, noticing the feeling of the fabric and noticing what you're doing, not getting distracted. It could be even when you're talking to your friends and really actually actively listening. That is a type of meditation. And yet it's not what we necessarily associate with that word.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, of even continuing to expand beyond movement meditations, that it's in everything, and the practice is for, and that's its own another ironic, paradoxical, you know, what are we practicing this for? More practice.
Practice is the exact word that I use as well, because it really speaks to the long-term longevity of this, because it's an ongoing, you know, pursuit that really just never ends. I mean, even, you know, at the end of your life, it's not done. It's not something you can check off your list, right? So it's something that is everlasting. And, you know, that could be sad, but in a way it's beautiful too, because it transcends time, you know, it transcends one person's lifetime and carries on to the next. So we're always really, you know, that comes back down to, again, the interconnectedness, where we're passing on these teachings to other people and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up as well. And that's part of consciousness being, well, very surface, also so deep, because how do you talk about consciousness without talking about space and time and free will and life and death? And it is that reminder of what is eternal, of what goes beyond those things. And
it's a funny tricky thing to talk about, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and to teach about and to attempt to, it's the thing too, that brings Heisenberg principle to mind, of observing something changes the something. And so in discussing consciousness, it's this game where you can show someone more of their consciousness, and then you're also changing something as you're doing it.
I agree with that. That makes sense. I think it seems almost presumptuous sometimes for me to think about teaching it to others, because it's really more about pulling it out of them, I guess, or helping them manifest it, because it's really already within them, right? So a lot of times my clients will say, oh, thank you so much, and you really made such a huge difference. And, you know, I appreciate that. And, you know, I definitely acknowledge and, you know, give myself credit. You know, that's part of self-care. But I also, you know, look at my client and I say, you know, you've really put in the work and you've, you know, dedicated yourself. So, I mean, it's a back and forth, you know, it's a bridge of communication there. And sometimes I think it's funny to be a teacher because, you know, I think it's the whole cliche of the student is the teacher, and teachers learn so much from their students. And so it's really this exchange of energy and wellness between the two people or multiple people.
It is. It keeps that whole circle, eternal loop going. I would be curious with what you were saying about outside distractions, how much your work as a teacher is to help people remove those distractions.
That's a great question. I think it's not so much about removing them, but acknowledging and minimizing the control that they have over our lives. And that's something that I'm learning as well. Of course, I mean, here we are using technology, and that can be a distraction. But I think learning to use it as a tool rather than as something that you cannot live without. And that's where I think it comes into play in both life and work, in that we need to, you know, utilize the things and the people and the tools around us in a way that really facilitates self-growth. So, for example, there's a difference between posting on Instagram for your business and scrolling endlessly for 3 hours with your eyes glazing over, right? And those are tough spots, because scrolling through Instagram, of course, is, you know, can be considered research and development. It could be considered, you know, looking at the competition and getting ideas from other people, but there really needs to be a limit to that so that it is actually useful.
Yeah, that the intention and also the actual action of how you're doing it and how long.
Agreed. I think it could be really helpful for all of us, including myself, to maybe ask ourselves, one, are we enjoying this? And two, is this actually making a difference? So I have this little saying, this little drawing in my bathroom from an artist, and it has like these three little kind of questions or mantras on it. And I'm going to paraphrase. They say something like, is this truthful? Is this helpful? Is it helping me reach my goals? And so having those in my mind are really useful so that I make sure that I'm actually getting something out of what I'm doing, and that it's not just something I'm doing because I'm supposed to. And I think that's what's really hard for people. They're like, I have to be on Instagram and Facebook and all of that. And I do coach people on social media strategy and marketing and whatnot. But a lot of times the way it's taught really sucks the joy out of it. And I actually am really happy that I recently found a way to enjoy Instagram again. And when I'm, you know, creating, you know, the content for it, it's actually become fun again. And it's just something that I haven't really heard talked about anywhere else. I actually was talking to a consultant about it, and she said, well, it's not supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be enjoyable. And I was like, you know, I reject that notion. I don't think that's true. And so I found a way for it to be just a pleasure again. And I hope to teach that to others.
I love how calmly you said, I reject that notion. What shifted for you? What in your perspective, what in the consciousness for you also shifted?
What shifted for me was the idea that I could be my authentic self on Instagram and still attract an audience, followers, clients. And I was a bit worried at first because I think before I thought of myself as, you know, providing services and whatnot and kind of being really scared to be 1,000% myself, because I was like, you know, a lot of companies, they espouse being non-political, just being neutral. And I think finding other people, especially women of color, who are just openly like, I, you know, am like bi POC, you know, supporter. I only work with Black and Indigenous peoples, or people who, there's this Instagram account and it's how not to travel like a basic bitch. And she talks a lot, or I don't know their gender pronouns, but this person talks about cultural appropriation and how to travel in a way that is socially conscious and that is just very aware. And when I saw that, I was like, wow, so that I can say all these things that I think and still be quote unquote successful, still have this huge following, because there will be other people who believe in this too. And just, I think accepting a little bit more that if people get offended, it doesn't mean that I need to change. Of course, I'm always open and receptive to people's thoughts. And, you know, of course I come from some areas of privilege. So I'm very open to hearing when people might question, you know, my phrasing. I know earlier, I think I actually used the word crazy, which was not the best word choice. It's a bit ableist. It's a bit, you know, not the most sensitive word to use. And so I actually really realized that I could call myself out on things and work with people who are okay with that too, who want me to call them out on their bullshit the way that I want people to do for me. And I think that's really going to be the key to success, because it's genuine.
Damn. And if you're going to be teaching consciousness, then that also, like you were saying too, of doing your own practice and your own decluttering and dropping distractions, dropping other people's stories to get really to the essence of your consciousness, your the word quintessence. I haven't said that word out loud in a long time. Where it's getting to you. And it's cool too to see how things have shifted from that very corporate, like you were saying, perspective of, you know, don't be a human, essentially. Any sort of political, spiritual, religious background, pretend like you don't have any sort of humanity to you. And to me, what I was hearing you say is that you're seeing the ways that you can open yourself up to more people, and also to people with, for the cliche word of alignment, people that you are in alignment with, by sharing more authentically.
Yes, absolutely. I have to say that it is pretty scary to say it, because it just means that I'm opening myself to more critique, and a lot of people who, you know, are probably more well-versed in, you know, social justice, of course I'm always learning, may, you know, critique me on things or, you know, have feedback that I don't want to hear. But that in itself is so beautiful and definitely what I want to attract in my life. I think I've been scared sometimes when I'll go to open mic nights or things like that. And I think, am I quote unquote woke enough, right? Maybe I'm not as woke as some other people, right? And of course there's some people who are like, whoa, you're like the most liberal person I know, the most like politically active. And I'm just like, I'm just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there's so many people who have dedicated so much more time and effort and, you know, money and tears and all of that into it than I have. And, you know, I think I can only do what I can, and I need to not compare myself to people, because we all have different emotional bandwidths. We have different capabilities and skills. So I do hope that I can attract people who are in alignment, and maybe I can attract people who also want to be, you know, more socially conscious, really be of service to people, especially marginalized groups, but maybe in a way where they can still, you know, get enough sleep, get enough exercise, and take care of themselves. Because that's such a hard thing when one is trying to be an activist. I noticed that a lot of, you know, activists get really burnt out and they just sacrifice their entire lives. And that is, you know, maybe inevitable. I don't know. It depends on the person. But, you know, I think if we can keep ourselves running longer, that means we can help more people. So that's definitely a goal and an ideal that I think we're all striving for.
Yeah, there's no connecting with other consciousness if we're not connecting with our own. And that activist burnout and just that general passion burnout is such a real thing that happens when people care.
It is. I'm constantly exhausted, not even physically, but just, you know, mentally. And, you know, I'm the kind of person who I want to feel things and I don't want to shut myself off to things. Every time I see a homeless person on the road, when I pass by them, I feel sad. And I know a lot of people have kind of cut that off from themselves because it's very hard to live that way, you know, and it can really impact one's life to just kind of think about that all the time. I talked to a friend of mine who said that she actively avoids working with homeless people when it comes to volunteer work because it would just make her question her privilege and, you know, where she is at in life, and she's not ready for it, or she's not interested in going into that. And I thought, you know, that was really insightful because, one, it was really honest, and two, of course, like, she wants to volunteer, but maybe that's not where her time is best spent. So, you know, she wants to work with animals, and I think that, you know, we can't all do the same thing, right? We can't all be doctors, we can't all be therapists, we can't all be activists in the same way, but we can do it in our own field and our own style. One example personally is that I thought about becoming a therapist, you know, doing CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. I found a lot of great use from it, but I realized that's not a role that's suitable for me, and it would just really drain me. And so then I wouldn't be able to work at my best and work at my fullest potential.
Because of how your consciousness was impacted by it?
Exactly, just because I'm an empath and I would absorb all those feelings, and I am consciously choosing not to turn off my emotions, or what is the word, to compartmentalize. You know, that's not really the kind of person I am, and I think that there are plenty of people who can and want to do that. And so, you know, what I can do is I go to therapy and I support them with my money, right? And, you know, I recommend other people go to therapy, and so I can support in that way.
And then do the work that feels good to you to do, which then is what can actually help other people.
Exactly. I think what I've seen is that therapists, a lot of times, they're very much about talking about feelings, and they're very much a sounding board. And, you know, one of my clients actually does go, and he has found it super helpful. So, I mean, I can't take credit. He was doing it before we started together. And so I was really happy to hear that he, you know, invested in that for himself. And, you know, my work is more about creating a little bit of structure in someone's schedule. So kind of you know, scheduling in that nap, scheduling in time for partners and family, and helping people realize that that needs to be blocked out in their calendar as well, just like they would block out time for meetings or phone calls or, you know, photo shoots, that kind of thing.
How would you connect consciousness and boundaries, given what you're saying with scheduling there?
That's a huge one. Boundaries is also something I work on as well, because it's something that ties in a lot with, I think, self-respect and self-esteem and confidence and self-love. And boundaries, it means, I think, what I'm thinking of is knowing when to say no to a potential work opportunity or the potential of, you know, I need to be on Facebook so that I don't miss a single message, or I need to be checking my emails constantly because this could be, you know, a great lead, or, you know, I could make X amount from this. And the boundaries part comes with saying my time alone or with my friend or family, what have you, is just as, if not more important as this potential client. And no, I'm not going to be on my computer all day long just because someone might message me. I mean, you know, if we think that way, then we can never sleep, we can never eat. And, you know, I've been in that habit before. I do that. I'll eat lunch and check my emails at the same time, or cook while I'm on a phone call. And it's just, you know, really not great for either party, honestly. And when I set boundaries for myself, or when my client sets boundaries for themselves, then that really translates or conveys to the other person that they can do it too. You know, it kind of gives permission to the other person to take time for themselves when they see, oh wow, like so-and-so is doing it, am I allowed to do it too? It opens up a lot of possibilities.
Wow, there's a lot of great stuff in there. And that last point especially is huge, that in the same way any action can help inspire someone else in their action, that we're all getting inspiration from other people's actions, that setting boundaries gives other people permission to do that as well.
I definitely attest that to some of the people I've surrounded myself with. A personal friend of mine from high school, she was always just, you know, a shining beam of light. And it's funny because her name is actually related to the sun. And so she really embodies the kind of peace and joy, but without lecturing or telling people how she does it, she just lives it. And just being friends with her, spending time with her, really taught me to teach by leading and leading as an example. So it's something I still struggle with, of course, because sometimes people want the step-by-step, oh, A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, and that can be a little more concrete, especially for artists. Again, I work with creatives, so they're already kind of in the abstract. They're already very, you know, creative. And so the ABC does, you know, play a very important role. So it's always a mix there. And I'm just really grateful to have so many people around me that live their lives in such a way that inspires me to be even better.
You become the people you surround yourself with is some truth for sure. And that goes that goes back to what you were saying with not being able to teach consciousness to someone. What you can do is be as conscious as you can be personally, and then show up for someone as consciously as you can for them personally, and be conscious along their process of connecting to their consciousness, which is like what a messy sounding sentence for something that really is two people sitting there and noticing their breathing, noticing their body, noticing maybe where they're holding tension or what thoughts are coming up. Or
it is a funny marriage of simplicity and complexity, because when you boil it down, it is about, I think, listening to what's on the other person's heart. And that's very rare to come across these days, I think. But at the same time, you know, the complexity of it is the nuance and the fact that each person is so different. And so with me, I work one-on-one, and so I tailor the approach. You know, it's not a formula like some other coaches where there's, you know, an online course with modules that you follow and, you know, worksheets that every single person does. So it is difficult and nuanced in that sense, but also the heart of it is, as you said, being human, which turns out is a lot harder than it sounds. I mean, I don't think we've quite figured it out yet, or that we ever will.
I agree. It seems like that's part of the whole human game here, is that it's so hard and so easy at the same time, and we know how to do it exactly, and we have no idea what we're doing.
Exactly.
It's cool that you tailor the how you work with people. And to me, that really is directly using consciousness again, rather than saying, oh, well, here's this program and it's going to work for everybody.
Yeah, so I'm really glad it comes across that way. That's definitely the intention. And I resonated with what you said about a messy sentence, because I'm always struggling on how to explain what I do to people, because it is, you know, so complicated and it really varies. So a lot of times, you know, I can't tell them what it's going to be like, because we're going to create that program together, right? And I'm going to ask my, you know, clients, I give them suggestions and examples, but we adjust as we go. And maybe we try something for a couple of weeks, and then, you know, I notice that maybe it's not the best fit for them. I might say, you know, hey, I notice this isn't really, you know, working for you. I see some, you know, maybe alternatives that would be better. And so it's not something that at the get-go I can say, this is exactly what it's going to be like, because part of my job is listening to what that person needs and kind of making it more organized, because they might throw a bunch of stuff at me and not really understand or know what they're trying to find. And it's part of my job to arrange that in a way that is approachable, and to basically, if you think of like a tangled mess of yarn, that I'm unraveling the yarn and creating it into these neat little balls. But in order to do that, they have to share the messy, tangled yarn with me first. And I don't see that until we start working together.
I love that connection and that metaphor with it. And with the, like you said, if they don't give you that mess, then there's no yarn to detangle.
I understand it's scary though, because showing that messy part, vulnerability. Showing that messy part is the scary part. Go ahead, sorry.
I was going over you too. I said, even though we're all messy, we all have some tangles in our internal human yarns.
I think continuing with that metaphor, which I have to give credit to some image that I saw online actually, that it seems like a lot of us like to just in the front of us show the neat bundled up, you know, balls of yarn that we've already finished up or that already look presentable, you know, that you would see at like, you know, the store. But the messy tangled part is stuff that we hide. And I acknowledge, you know, and respect that it takes time for people to slowly show that, because it's embarrassing and it's vulnerable. And a lot of us have been through experiences where people were not kind when people shared. And we've all had that person who rejected, you know, our sharing, who responded poorly to it, who criticized instead of, you know, evaluated and held their hand. So it's very valid for people to take their time. And that's a big part of the process. A big part of what you said, boundary, is going at your own pace. And I'll always tell my clients, when I ask a question, you are always free to say, I'm not ready to share that yet, or I'm not going to share that with you. something along those lines, because that's a way for them to show up for themselves.
To know their own, what yarn they're willing to show at what time.
Mm-hmm.
So then in this extended metaphor, the yarn is our consciousness, and it can be messy or neat.
Yes, and messy and neat are, they could be the same thing, right? I mean, for some of us, the messiness maybe is, you know, it's like the whole, like people who are messy, but they know where everything is, right? And so it's not so black and white where it's like two ends of the spectrum, neat and messy. They're, you know, for some people, maybe being neat really hinders their growth and it's too structured. And so all of that requires a little bit of tweaking. Some of us need a little bit more chaos in our lives than others. And that chaos can manifest in different ways, whether it's physically like a messy room, or if it's, you know, maybe people who like to travel a lot, I would say that that's like their kind of like messiness. They like that uncertainty. They like the thrill of not knowing, the lack of control. So I would say that's big and different in everyone, definitely.
Yeah, I love extended metaphors to make it feel more accessible to talk about things that seem as expansive as consciousness and meditation and mindfulness and teaching yoga and giving it something that seems a little, that seems simpler.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for running along with the metaphor. I hope it makes sense to some of our listeners out there. Analogies are kind of hit or miss sometimes, you know, and things like that. So again, you know, if you look at an abstract painting, everyone sees something a little different. So I'm imagining that our listeners are kind of having their own version of this in their heads that makes sense for them.
Totally. Yeah. Reach out and let us know. There was another, like the abstract metaphor in the head is another, or how it is showing people's head is another metaphor for consciousness that it's going to be interpreted through different lenses so differently based on whatever upbringing and whatever personal characteristics somebody has. That's the fun part of this, right? Is like we can go and compare our yarns or notice different things about the different yarns or make structures or art or whatever with them.
I think comparing yarns it can be really fun. And I think as long as we remember that kind of intention, as you said before, is where it'll really suit us, because it should be enjoyable and not used as a way to tear ourselves down. And that's a tough one, as with anything else. I mean, the most valuable things worth doing are very challenging and full of twists and turns.
Yes, they are. There's going to be a challenge with it. And that, well, to go to that intention with comparison, this seems like a good place to specifically address mental health and how that ties in with consciousness and the different intentions of, quote, comparing yarn and saying you can do it from that black or white, better or worse, or saying, you know, messy and neat and one of those is good and bad, versus you can have the perspective that is noticing and playing. And for me, that is so much of my practice with my mental health, is what is my self-talk around this consciousness.
Thank you so much for sharing. I'm definitely the same way when it comes to how it manifests in self-talk. And consciousness, I think, is really well used when we describe what we're actually feeling instead of using labels that are a bit superficial or vague. So, for example, instead of saying bad, maybe we mean it's unsatisfying or it's disappointing. Or when we say good, we mean that it is inspiring. Perhaps it means that we're feeling awake and refreshed. And so I think really just being a little bit more descriptive with ourselves, even if I think to myself, oh, I'm sad, it can be very easy just to kind of wallow in that bottomless pit of, oh, sad and depression. But maybe really pinpointing, I'm sad because of this, or sadness is manifesting, or sadness is in the air, that can help kind of point to how ephemeral these feelings are. Because, you know, if I'm to say I am sad, it sounds so, you know, decided. Wow, okay, I'm sad, like I embody it, like that's who I am. And that's a bit heavy. So something I learned in the yoga studio, something we would say is to kind of notice, oh, sadness is arising, or anger is arising, or something to that extent. You can rephrase it however you want. But maybe I would say detaching it from who you are as a person.
Yes, that, well, I love, and thus the comic in me wants to start writing while I say those things, also wants to make stand-ups about, like, I am noticing the rising of sadness in my because it's real, because it's rooted in truth, that I'm that distinction between saying I am sad versus I feel sad is a huge shift. And I, for me as well, having that pointed out to my consciousness, that saying I am sad is a heavy sentence.
Right. And I think it reminds me of earlier when we talked, you and me, about how I have this habit of saying I'm so impatient. And then after I say that, adding to it and saying, I am building my patience. I am growing my patience, developing it. And, you know, I don't have to retract the words I said before, because, you know, I can't, but I can move forward and give it a little bit more nuance to what I'm saying. It's not that I'm impatient, but it's that my patience level can improve and increase. And I think that gives us a little bit more space to move forward instead of feeling so stuck in where we are.
Shows you other possibilities. And just, and like you said, with space, it shows you that there's the space for a different perspective.
I think, yeah, definitely. The reason I kind of talk about that is because I myself, you know, my background, I grew up with depression and anxiety from a very young age, you know, around maybe 3 or so. And, you know, I had, you know, no control over my anger. And it was just I could even tell even at that young age that it was, you know, not normal, I would say. It wasn't like, you know, the level of anger versus the situation were not compatible with each other. And so I'm speaking from, you know, having gone through it. You know, I always want to kind of talk to my students or clients or whoever, and, you know, with acknowledgement that I have been through all of it and I get it, you know, because, you know, no one wants someone that's kind of just standing in their soapbox lecturing about something that they have no idea about, right? They've read about it in books, or, you know, they've seen it on TV, but it's different to really live it. And so I hope that, you know, gives some perspective to what I'm saying.
Yes, absolutely. And I would love to hear more about that perspective and how, when you got into your own practice with any sort of meditation or any mindfulness practices or yoga, and how those practices connected with your experiences with mental health and with learning new ways to process and express anger.
Sure, I can definitely share that. Thank you for creating that space to do so. It's always a tricky one for me because, you know, I don't want to come across as, you know, feeling sorry for myself. And yet, you know, I want to be very upfront about it. So a difficult balancing act, I think. In the past, when I've mentioned it to people, they've, you know, kind of accused me of playing the oppression Olympics. And so I just want to make a disclaimer that that is not the point of what I'm going to say. And of course, you know, all within context. So for me, I really felt, even at such a young age, that I didn't want to live anymore. And that started, I think I verbalized that for the first time to my parents at age 11, around the fourth grade. So pretty early on. And I wasn't taken very seriously. So that was really difficult. And I sought out yoga and meditation because, you know, the internet was kind of new those days. And I went on my like desktop and looked up ways to help deal with depression. And I also was dealing with sleepwalking and sleep talking. I had horrible, violent nightmares, which I sometimes do still have. And so I just knew that I needed to find something. And I didn't know what it was going to be. I think meditation came up first, and I really couldn't find many meditation classes in my area, if at all. And so yoga was the next closest thing. It took a while to convince my parents to take me. And, you know, of course, they would have to drive me and such. And, you know, there's also the background of my parents being immigrants, and I'm Asian American. So historically, statistically, Asian Americans, you know, AAPI folks, do not talk about mental health. It's not part of the language or the culture. And so a lot of that has helped me forgive a little bit more, because I was definitely angry with my parents for more of my life in not helping me more. And I did feel very alone, you know. And what was hard too was that the yoga studio, you know, most of the people I was practicing with, even when I did my training to become certified, were older, right? People in their 40s, 50s, 60s, athletes who had injuries and were kind of learning to slow down in their lives and really just look around them. And most of these people had families and kids. And so it was sometimes not the easiest to make connections. So, you know, I'm glad that I was able to continue with it, because, you know, if not for that, I don't know what else. I mean, I'm sure I could have gotten into drugs and alcohol like a lot of people do. But luckily for me, I was at the studios on the weekends, usually 4 to 8 hours, you know, on Saturday, Sunday. And I think that kept me out of trouble and, you know, kept me from self-sabotaging. And that's why I really want to teach it to other people, because it has literally saved my life. And I also see so much yoga out there that is very westernized, very exercise oriented, and that is literally one eighth of what yoga is about. It's one of the eight limbs of yoga. So that's a little bit about me, and you know, if anyone wants to reach out to me, I'm happy to share more.
I really appreciate you being so open to talk about that. And personally, having some overlaps in those experiences and getting to hear and share and connect with someone who also voiced any sort of awareness of suicide as an option, any sort of desires, any sort of thinking about it at a very young age. And I don't normally share that with people, or don't normally talk about it with people, because the story I tell myself is it's not a very common occurrence, and also that people don't want to hear about it. And also, like you opened with, that then people can, and the ironies abound with mental health topics of people saying, oh, you're doing this for attention. You're saying poor me, or you're being aggressive with you're being dramatic or whatever it is.
You can't see me, but I'm nodding along to all of this. It's definitely true. And it's a tough struggle, because I think we have to be mindful of how people are going to receive it and whether or not they're in a state where they can emotionally cope with it, because it can be very triggering. And a lot of times when I've shared this with people, it's scary because they realize they think it too. And it may be a repressed thought or memory that they didn't remember until that point. So it's a delicate issue, and I don't talk about it lightly. I don't bring it up as casually in conversations as I used to anymore, because consciousness also means recognizing the time and place to talk about this with people, and whether or not, again, that question, is this honest? Is it going to help, right? If this is just going to debilitate this person, then it's not the best decision to bring it up at that point.
Totally. Well, it's amazing that hearing your story that at such a young age, and also in that vulnerability and the challenge of having all of these big emotions come up and having little to no idea how to navigate them, or even where to go to learn to navigate them, that you took so much initiative.
It's really kind of you to say that, and I appreciate it. I like what you said about normalizing it, because I remember talking about it with a friend in college, and she said the statement that shocked me, and she said, oh, doesn't everyone think about that? It's normal. And her background, actually, she's from China, so maybe it's different, but I don't think actually that many Asians would say that it's a big topic there. So I actually found that statement to be kind of reassuring, because it does have the ability to make people feel like, oh, well, I'm not a freak and I'm not like messed up. And sure, we can, I guess, step into the idea of, oh, we're all a little messed up, which can be comforting too. But I think when it comes down to the permission again, like if I say it to someone that I'm close to, and, you know, I've asked them ahead of time, you know, if they're okay with hearing it, and if they're like in an emotionally stable place, then that means that they can begin to process it too, or we can kind of, the phrase that's coming to mind is compare notes. It sounds a little funny, but maybe like commiserate with each other and encourage the other person to go to therapy if they're not already, or to, you know, seek other types of therapy such as sports or hobbies, journaling, that kind of thing. So I hope that the viewers can kind of walk away with this feeling that if they have felt this way, or they currently or in the future feel this way, that it is not a reflection on them as a person. It's not a crime or a wrongdoing of theirs, and that it is something to be taken seriously, but it doesn't define a person. So I hope we can all remember that we are very complex and not just the result of one feeling or one action.
Thank you for putting that out there for people. It reminds me of a Carl Rogers quote that says, "The curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change."
That's a good one.
Myself, and accept that things are going to change. That the feeling is going to change, that my understanding and my awareness, my navigated, is going to change.
Change is one of the only constants, and that's probably why I feel really comfortable with change, funnily enough. So,
would you say consciousness is a constant?
Ooh, consciousness. I feel like it doesn't even need to be said that it's a constant in a way. It's just something that, yeah, it's there whether you know it or not, and it is not something that's just a human thing. I think it's something beyond our reach, really, to understand and even define it. So, in a short answer, yes, And a long answer, also yes, but with more descriptors and nuances and whatnot. So a bit of a long-winded answer to just say yes, I suppose.
Consciousness can be long-winded for sure. It can just be a breath and it can be the messy yarn.
And the question is, how long is that breath, right? What if that one breath is all of eternity?
Oh, I live for this sort of stuff. I love those sort of questions. We may never know. Our consciousness can just scratch the surface of it and then get mentally upset and then have new things to learn from the upset to scratch new surfaces.
Yeah, definitely. It's an adventure, like I said, and it's going to continue even after we're gone. And I think that's the fun part, not knowing and leaning into that and being okay with it.
Yeah, riding the wave. I would love to hear what you'll be walking away from this tangle and detangle through consciousness chat with.
I want to walk away and take some more of my own advice and live a little less technology and to put into effect the things that I know work and that I recommend to others. So cooking and eating without an electronic by my side or in front of me, and having more of these conversations with people when it comes up organically and stepping into it, probably journaling more, and those are the actions, and then just being and being more comfortable being even when it's not productive. So that's going to be the big scary challenge I set for myself.
Do you count rest as productive?
Yes, 100%. That's one of my mottos. I tell that to everyone.
Rest is productive.
It's the foundation of everything, and it's free, which is why people are shy away from it, right? I mean, they assume the cure is in some expensive chemical-ridden drug, some kind of pill or panacea. But at the end of the day, we all just need to sleep a little more.
It's so real. I'm laughing because it's more of the cliches or more of the paradoxes, which are like, oh, are you dehydrated or hungry or tired? Like, we're all big babies.
Yeah, we are big babies. It's, what's it called? It sounds so basic, and that's why it's so real. And we can keep spinning around chasing fancy, bougie, colorful solutions, but we're always going to come back to food, water, and love. So,
yes.
Full circle.
Yes. I love that you shared about following your own advice too, for that listening to your own consciousness. We are each our own guru, teacher, sort of a reminder.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on and taking the time to do this. I really hope that it's been great for you as well. And I'm excited to hear what the listeners have learned and taken away from this.
Yeah, me too. Please reach out and let us know how your consciousness is feeling these words on consciousness. Thank you again for your time, and I will put your information in the description so people can find you and reach out.
All right, sounds great.
Thank you so much for tuning in, and thanks for being you.
Hey, thanks for sticking around till the end. Please check out the annyealtmanshow.com and also patreon.com/theannyealtmanshow if you're able and interested in donating $1 or more per month to these projects. Non-dollar ways to share value includes and is not limited to sharing anything, the podcast, any YouTube video, any blog post, any social media account, subscribing, following anywhere, rating or reviewing anything, sending any feedback or ideas, and or connecting me with people for the podcast or other projects you feel would enjoy this work. In my opinion, word of mouth is the only, quote, real advertising, so here I am using words from my mouth.